All right, well, Stefan, thank you very much for joining us here at CHRY.
It's my pleasure.
I think there are a couple things I'd like to talk about, but I feel like there will be this common thread, your experiences, and then we can talk also about the role that media plays in these kinds of social movements. Mm-hmm. The last time that we spoke, you were on the phone in the Philippines and you were discussing the outcome of recent elections there. You took part in an observer's mission, and there were delegates from multiple countries there, and you raised a number of issues when we spoke about A, the levels of violence and intimidation surrounding the election. You're also pointing out the problem of having electronic ballots being administered by a private corporation from Canada. But I'm wondering, now that you have returned, what are the most important lessons that you've gleaned from your experience there?
Well, I think the first and strongest impression is the power of the social movements in the Philippines. Given the extreme poverty, a country now where 69% of the population self-identifies as poor, and you have over 50 million people living below the poverty line. In that context, social movements are thriving on multiple fronts. There are efforts to build parallel health and education systems within the urban poor areas. All surrounding Manila, you have a belt of urban poor communities. Mainly people who have left the countryside, entered into the capital region. Manila now, the area, Metro Manila, has over 20 million people. So these communities are mainly landless peasants from the countryside. And given the current economic inequities in the country, it's important to understand that within the historical context, which is that there are many echoes of a feudal system. So you have ancient power structures that are really rooted back to the Spanish colonial era in landlords that control major territories throughout the country. Peasants and farmers, let's say, live on those territories and make menial livings. And that power structure plays into the politics because a lot of those families, those major landowners in the Philippines, are also running for office and hold a lot of sway, political sway, because of the position of power they hold, a position of power that was very much entrenched by the Spanish colonial context and administration of the country, and then later on the American colonization. So although that is extreme and that condition creates a lot of poverty, the social movements are very vibrant. And so that's the thing I take away from the Philippines that remains in my mind and in my heart until today. But the last thing I'd say on that point is that in response to the reality, the social movements are incredibly strong. And the efforts to struggle for democratic space, for unionization of workers, the student movement in the Philippines is highly organized and very effective. And because of that highly organized social movement, in the face of this economic inequity we discussed, those movements are facing repression. And that's essentially why we were there, was to be eyes and ears to witness the repression carried out against those social movements by those same structures of power, mainly administered by private armies and the armed forces of the Philippines, the military, which has a joint training agreement with Canada. So those are a few impressions.
So returning to the idea of the role of media in these social movements, I'd like to know a bit more about your involvement with Tademan. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you can speak about Tademan, its origins and its objectives.
Well, I'll just try and keep a stream through our conversation. My work as a journalist has focused quite a lot on looking at, let's say, the relationship between social justice organizing in Canada and international solidarity. So often when I've traveled to the Philippines, if we're talking about trips to the Philippines, and also I've traveled to the Middle East and done work in Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan, as both an independent journalist and a solidarity activist, the work as a journalist was always tied to my engagement within social justice issues locally in Montreal or in Canada. So in regards to the Philippines, quickly, the work on the Philippines came out of and the travel to the Philippines came out of our support for Filipino migrants in Côte de Neige area in Montreal, which is an immigrant area in Montreal. And we worked in defense of the rights of Filipino migrants facing both deportation by Immigration Canada, but also abuse through the Live-In Caregiver Program. So in extension to that, I traveled to the Philippines. It was the Filipino community that invited me to Manila for the first time in 2007, and then again in 2010. My work on the Middle East mainly stems from experiences working with the International Solidarity Movement, similar in principle to our role in the Philippines that we just discussed. But the role of the International Solidarity Movement, the ISM, was basically to create this international network of international social justice activists to work on the ground in Palestine and throughout the Middle East to support the struggles of the Palestinian people for self-determination. My experiences with the International Solidarity Movement, an organization that has origins dating back to around the beginning of the Second Intifada, but actually that group is directly tied to the political process that led to the Gaza Freedom Flotilla, and also is the organization which Rachel Corey, who was killed in Gaza, crushed by an Israeli bulldozer, an American citizen. She was also a member of that group at the same period that I was. My work with the ISM extended to local work in Montreal after traveling to the Middle East, and some of us formed a group called Tadamon, which is a collective that supports the global campaign for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against the Israeli state. We work in solidarity with Israeli and Palestinian activists locally and globally to support the self-determination of the Palestinian people. My reporting on Palestine and writing on Palestine has always been informed by my belief that the Palestinian people, like all others on the planet, must be granted self-determination, and that Palestinians are actively struggling for that self-determination, and I'm one of many around the world that is supporting that struggle.
One of the reasons I'm particularly curious about Tadamon is also just because it introduces this connection with community radio as well. I was curious to find out about the fact that the program at CKUT in Montreal began in the spring of 2006, and that in July of 2006, members were actually sent to Lebanon as part of an international solidarity delegation, and this coincided with Israel's attack on Lebanon. And so I'm wondering if you can talk about those kinds of experiences where you initiate a project, something like Tadamon being involved in radio, and you are put into a situation, something as dramatic as this. How do you react, and how does that define your outlook or your resolve when you're now involved with these campaigns and you're involved in telling these stories or ensuring that these stories are documented?
Well, I was in Lebanon when the Israeli attack happened in 2006, and that's not an experience you forget easily. When Israel bombed Lebanon in 2006, the world was shocked, rightfully so. In response to Hezbollah, the Lebanese political party and also resistance organizations, they captured two Israeli soldiers. When I was there in 2006, I hadn't obviously expected that to happen. I don't think many people around the world did. But it was important to be there at that time because it is meaningful and I think important to experience that type of reality, the reality that people in Lebanon or in Palestine in a different way, but I think from a similar force, the Israeli army, have been experiencing for decades and decades, dating back to 1948, which is the date of the creation of the Israeli state. 2006, when bombs hit Beirut, the ground shook, and we were in the city center listening and watching the destruction. Seeing that and also the resilience of the people in Lebanon to face such a massive onslaught of attack by the fourth largest military in the world, carried out mainly by airplanes, military planes, unleashing lethal bombs onto civilian areas in Beirut. When you see that, sure, I mean, it's important, and I think it informs your perspective on the reality of the region. So when you see headlines in the Globe and Mail or hear reports on CBC, you have a human sense of what those bombs mean for people's lives, and also a human sense as to why some choose to participate in organizations and movements like Hezbollah that fight for a Lebanon that is free of Israeli colonization, and a Lebanon that is independent, and a Lebanon that is self-determined by its own people. You can agree or not with the politics of or the social values of Hezbollah, which is actually a banned organization in Canada, which I feel is completely absurd. You can have your opinions on that, but the reality is in Lebanon that it's a major political force and is highly popular and is seen as a very principled player in the region, given their role in resisting the Israeli occupation of southern Lebanon that dates from the late 1970s until 2000, right? So there's a history and context to the war in 2006 in Lebanon that is often removed from the mainstream media or political discourse on understanding that war in 2006. And so I say that the listing of Hezbollah as a quote-unquote terrorist organization in Canada is absurd, not in the sense of agreeing or disagreeing with what Hezbollah is about, but because you can't have any honest political discussion about any conflict unless you take into account the opinions and the reality of all the major political players at the table. And Hezbollah is one of those players. And I saw in 2006 during the war the role that they played in Lebanon, which is a important role, agree with it or not, but one to consider, one to think about, and one to try to understand if you want to have any in-depth or meaningful understanding about Lebanon or the Middle East.
You were commenting that you were actually in Toronto about 8 years ago, mm-hmm. the last time that G8 meetings were held in this city. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could maybe make a similar comparison to the efforts that were taking place, the organizing that was taking place at that point 8 years ago, and what you have seen so far this week taking place in the city.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, first of all, just say for listeners, maybe these topics seem, you know, quite
yeah, that's
broad.
That's fair.
We've talked about the Philippines and the reality today in the Philippines. We talked about Palestine. And popular opinion around Palestine today and its parallels and the comparisons that are being made to South Africa. Now we have the G8 and G20 summit in Toronto. The strain I would see through all of these points is maybe first the role that increasingly grassroots media activists are playing in illustrating alternative points of view as to the realities as depicted by major media on struggles and issues globally. Around the G8 and G20, I was reading the newspapers this morning here in Toronto, and one of the important points that comes to mind is the way that the political perspectives are portrayed in relation to power. What I mean by that is police and protesters, let's say, are almost placed on a playing field as if it's a football game. It's not a football game. Behind the police, you have state infrastructure, an over $1 billion security budget, a history, and a monopoly on violence. What I mean by that is you have police who hold the legal authority and also perceived authority, because it's not always legal, to administer weapons. And it lets us remember that the police are armed, not the protesters. So there's a major power imbalance that exists around the relationship between citizens who will be protesting and taking to the streets in large numbers, especially this upcoming weekend, and the state security forces and police. Not to say that each cop is not a citizen also. They are. and they've made their decisions about what they want to do in relation to the G20 and G8. However, the institution of the police and the RCMP and the security agencies around the G and G20 has seriously curtailed the civil liberties of people who are aiming to administer and to make vocal their dissent against the G8 and G20. And beyond that, the architecture of fear around the downtown core of Toronto, where they've constructed razor-sharp wall, steel barrier, layers of security perimeter around the core of the city, sticks to the heart, I think, directly to downtown Toronto and the soul of the city, the arrogance and the declaration of a conservative government in Ottawa that is willing to administer its ideology and support for economic policies that are increasingly unpopular since the economic final meltdown, I think that are very much married to the G8 process and intertwined with that process. So these meetings will be happening. The whole process itself is unaccountable. In the sense that the policies and the decisions made within the G8 and G20, there's no role for public consultation, or there's no relationship to the voices of citizens who will be critiquing these meetings. And those critiques are important, whether you agree with them or not. The role of a democratic society, or the basic concept of democracy, is having a field of ideas that is open, and a discourse and debate, a real debate around policy, right? And the walls and literally the fence that has been built around the G8 and, well, actually the G20 summit site in downtown Toronto symbolizes the stifling of real debate on the key issues that will be highlighted at the G8 and G20. It's not different from what we saw last time the G8 was in Canada in 2002, where we saw similar chill on dissent, and the meetings actually were taking place in Kananaskis, Alberta. Away from the world, there was major protests in both Calgary and Ottawa, street demonstrations, thousands of people that vocally administered their opposition and rejection of the G8 and G20 process as undemocratic on a global sense. Where are all the other countries, the over 70 countries at the United Nations who have formed their own bloc of nations unrepresented by the G20 process? So there was protest last time, there's protest this time, and the question really to ask is why every time the G8 meets or the G20 meets are there major street demonstrations? It's not random. There are profound reasons.
So it seems that preventing the G20 this year, it is a distant hope, but the expense and security measures attached to the summit, they continue to galvanize people in some way to oppose the security measures, to oppose the tactics of the G8-G20, even if there isn't this deep understanding of the policies and the issue of accountability as well. Do you see this as an opportunity? Is there a way, are there strategies to use to build a more critical mass of support?
Well, media plays a big role. And I think CHRY and our discussion today, I mean, is one drop in the bucket, but there is a global movement of media to highlight the voices that will not be projected on primetime interviews on CBC during the summit, which is unfortunate. You know, let's speak specifically. I think that the role of institutions like the Independent Media Center, and there's a media convergence here in Toronto of journalists from around Canada and also globally who will be reporting an alternative perspective as to what's happening at the G8 and G20 summits, and perspective from the streets. That's 2010.mediacoop.ca or toronto.mediacoop.ca, the independent media project. We're in an era where YouTube, Flickr, Twitter, etc. are playing such a central role in how we interact with each other in terms of social media, in terms of our understanding of current events, in terms of the flow of information. The whole model of social media, I think it's important to look at some of the first examples of when you had global networks of social media in action. And those weren't examples like Flickr and Twitter, which are important, YouTube, etc., today. But if we look to the origins of the anti-globalization movement as it's heard, or the major street protests that we saw erupt in North America against these processes of global governance bodies like the G8 and G20, or trade institutions like the WTO, the World Trade Organization, which many people, especially in the global south, find as completely undemocratic and have sparked protests globally. In Seattle in 1999, there was the creation of the Independent Media Center, indymedia.org with the Y. Globally, after that, there was this explosion of media centers from Argentina to Beirut, Lebanon to Mexico, Europe. These media centers played a critical role in articulating some of the roles and the ideas of social movements around the world. And it was an incredible thing to see happen. It grew like wildfire of voices that were excluded by the corporate media. When you go to a media convergence space, the first thing you will see at an independent media convergence is a person to welcome you. When you go to a corporate media institution, the first thing you'll see is a security guard. And I think that contrast is pretty stark, and it reflects the relationship between these institutions and society. So independent media is playing an important role in articulating an alternative view from the ground, from the streets, when these summits happen. And it's really important to consider the profound impact that indymedia.org and the subsequent explosion of indie media centers around the world played in shaping one of the first international networks of social media and social networking that happened globally, spontaneously, and around the world. That is one of the first examples that we've seen, and it put forward an idea of citizens' journalism and open publishing that's paramount to community radio, but to independent media in general, that reshaped citizens' relationship to the press, whereas these press institutions were no longer these inaccountable institutions that were inaccessible and happened in office towers of mystery, but became open processes where people could engage and contribute, hopefully. There's a lot of work to do, but I think that the idea of citizens' journalism and opening up that process speaks to larger ideas and beliefs in direct democracy and reshaping of power structures in our society.
All right. Well, Stefan, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to come and visit us.
It's
at
my
CHRY.
Pleasure.
And I can't wait to be out there with you and to help with the mobilizations as well. But thanks a lot.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.